everybody. I'm already got us 4 minutes behind schedule here. It's great to be here. I had to rush in. Today we had, just a quick announcement, our locks meeting. We're trying to unlock the locks on the river, and they usually, unfortunately, they keep scheduling them on the days that are night for MPAC, so it's kind of a rush. So Commissioner Lewis is still there and will probably be on her way because she and I both serve on that committee. And I don't think we have a quorum yet. So the first piece of the agenda, the consent agenda, we'll have to wait for. But why don't we get started and do introductions around the table. Michael Schrader, Clackamas County Commissioner.
I'm Megan Gibb, Land Use and Urban Development Manager, Metro.
Pete Truex, Mayor, City of Forest Grove, representing other cities in Washington County.
Rachel Lyle Smith, City of Oregon City, representing second largest city in Clackamas County.
Colin Rowan, I'm the Levy Ready Columbia Program Director and sitting as an alternate for Special Districts Small Business.
And Dick Scout on the Washington County Board of Commissioners.
Mark Watson, Hillsborough School Board, representing the School Board of Commissioners.
Warden Hubbies, 12 Valley Fire and Rescue, Special Districts in Washington County.
Jerry Hinton Gresham.
Linda Glover, City of Vancouver Council.
This is Sheila Jayapal, Multnomah County Commission.
Juan Carlos Gonzalez, Metro Council, representing North and West Washington County.
Don Pratt, Clackamas Fire, representing the Clackamas County.
Danny Doyle, City of Beaver, the second largest city in Washington County.
Sam Chase, Metro Council.
Mark Gamba, Mayor of Milwaukee.
Teresa Kohlhoff, Lake Oswego.
Can we start in the audience? I know.
Jeff Owen Trimet, apologies, Director Way cannot be here this evening. She's not feeling well.
Okay.
Adam Barber, Multnomah County Land Use Planning.
Okay. Okay, can we start back here? So I have to add, since I'm an alum of PSU, so what classes are you taking that they said you had to watch our meeting?
Introduction to civic engagement.
Pardon me?
Introduction to civic engagement.
Okay, well, we'll hopefully
so do well.
We're about as civic as they come.
And Ernie, you'll let me know if there's a quorum at some point.
I think you have the West Wing, so, Madam Chair. The West Wing has not reported.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go, West Wing.
Claire Machado, Metro. Gretchen Junior from City Council, alternate of the city's Washington County. Lisa Miles, Metro. Claire
Dowell,
Metro.
Kim O'Brien, Metro. Andy Shaw, Metro.
Okay, I think I'm done. Have I missed anything, anybody? Okay, looking good here. So I am going to go to any public communication, any member of the public that wants to testify. Now's your chance, ladies and gentlemen. You want to. How about a council update? And I know we have Sam and Juan. So let's go for it.
I have an update for everybody. Happy to see you all. It's broken up into three parts, so I'll just dive into the first, an update on the parks measure. In case you haven't heard, we're very excited that the 2019 Metro Parks and Natural Areas Bond measure earned the support of 67% of Metro Region voters. Hear, hear. And that includes 62% support in Clackamas and Washington counties. Hear, hear. That's massive. That's massive. And Multnomah was over 70%, I think. So, hear, hear. Greater Portland residents said yes to clean water, healthy fish, and wildlife habitat in nature close to home by investing $475 million in their regional park system. That's almost half $1 billion towards conservation, local parks, trails, etc. This bond measure builds on a quarter century of investments in healthy lands and healthy people, an accomplishment that we can take pride in. Through this bond measure, Metro is taking bold steps to make sure all people benefit from investments in nature, including people of color, indigenous peoples, people with disabilities, and others who have often been left out. And this is a historic moment for advancing equity in Greater Portland, and we worked our tails off to make sure that this was a groundbreaking legislation. This bond was shaped by community members and partners who will continue to have a voice, and over the coming months, we will share ways to get involved with selecting projects and bringing them to life. Metro is proud of its track record improving Greater Portland through investments that affect people's everyday lives, from affordable housing to parks, trails, and natural areas. And we hope the people who support this bond measure will also join the conversation about investing in safe and reliable transportation. As you may have seen, Metro has reached agreement to purchase an industrial site in Cornelius and is completing due diligence and community engagement over the next 12 months to see if it makes sense to build a facility there for a Westside transfer station. Due to Washington County's growing population and express support from the public, there is need for a modern garbage and recycling facility that can provide excellent and accessible services to the public. A new facility would provide various benefits to the community, ideas such as education and community spaces, career training, repair and reuse services, and other amenities will be decided through community engagement. And Metro is in the early stage of the process. No final decision will be made until after all due diligence is completed and the public has had a chance to weigh in on how a facility might serve the community's needs. And lastly, the Zoo Lights is back. The Oregon Zoo Lights will begin again on November 29th. We welcome everyone to see more than 1.5 million colored lights in our holiday tradition. The Zoo Lights features advanced tickets online at oregonzoo.org for a discount as well as early season discounts. And as always, parking is limited at Washington Park and by the end of rush hour, generally plentiful at the Sunset Transit Center. That's what the talking point said. Please use transit to get to the zoo. Talking points, that's it. It says upcoming schedule, so I don't think you need to know that. Thank you for allowing me to present the council update, Chair.
I certainly appreciate that. Sam, do you want to add anything? Where's Sam? Oh, he just walked out. Okay, well, he'll step down. He'll come back. So I've been told we have a quorum, so I am going to move us back to the consent agenda, which consists of two items: the minutes for the October 9th MPAC meeting, the minutes for the October 23rd MPAC meeting. So any...
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion or changes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, we're moving right along now. So we're going to start with our information discussion items. So I was going to call up Lisa Miles to get us started on the update on the 2040 planning and development grants. Okay. This is informational. It's really going to update us on the new policies regarding new grants and new grant policies and application processes, and that they will be implemented in the 2020 cycle. So thank you for coming here today. And Lisa, you are the Development Grants Program Manager, and Tim, you're the Principal Regional Planner. Very impressive. Okay. Take us away.
Great. Thank you very much. And we have some slides tonight, but also in your packets is this table, two-sided table, which sort of outlines the materials that we're going to be speaking about. So we'll try to get through the slides quickly so we can answer any questions you might have. So as many of you may be aware, we've been here before to talk about the 2040 Planning and Development Grants Program, which has been in effect since 2006, although under a previously different name, the Community Planning and Development Grants Program. So the program mission, though, has remained essentially the same over the years: to remove barriers to development, make land ready for development, and enable existing development sites to be redeveloped. Over the years, as policies have shifted in the region and to stay current with what local needs are, the program has evolved in its mission from originally focusing on the planning of new urban areas to then looking more at infill development, or including that as one of the things that we fund through the grant program. We had, most recently in 2016, we had a round of grants focusing on the planning and development of equitable housing. And then in the last three cycles that we've had, we've included funding and emphasized funding on programs that emphasized equitable development projects. We were here last fall for a discussion when there were some changes to some of the codes and policies around this program. Originally, the construction excise tax had a sunset, and that was lifted by the council last year so that this program could continue. We also made some changes in terms of making it possible for private entities to also apply for grants if they were partnered with a local government. And we continue to sort of redefine the how we were thinking about equitable development projects that could be eligible for this funding. We also came to you last July to tell you about the most recent grants that were funded, and some of you may remember that our screening committee in this most recent round of grants gave us some feedback that they really were hoping that we could take another look at how we could reframe the program to better meet some of Metro's equitable development goals. And so that's sort of the purpose we're here today. We've taken some time to review this program. We recently came before the Metro Council on October 29th at a work session to share some of our staff's proposals. And the council was comfortable with the direction that we were moving the program in. So Tim and I will tell you a bit about now how things are slated to change, and the council will be actually moving that ahead in early December. So I'll let Tim.
Thank you, Lisa. In an effort to streamline the program, we are proposing a separate application process for the new urban area planning grants. These grants can be concept plannings, which are green on the sheet that you have in front of you, which is for land that's to be planned prior to coming into the urban growth boundary, or comprehensive planning, which is the yellow portion of the sheet in front of you, which is for land that's already been added to the urban growth boundary. We're really making this change based on the fact that this work is really required to meet Metro code requirements that we have in Title 11 of the Urban Growth Management Functional Plan. So it's a very straightforward kind of application process with the scope of work. We're proposing to reserve 25% of the annual grant funds to be set aside in each grant cycle for the new urban area planning. And this is consistent with the amount of money that we've been setting aside for new urban area planning for the last few years, so that the amount of money is staying consistent. Looking back at the past concept planning grants, they've been generally in around $250,000 typically. That's kind of what we'd somewhat expect, this is unless they're a little more complex in nature. The concept planning grants applications will be accepted on an annual cycle. They will be reviewed by staff and make a recommendation to our chief operating officer. And then the COO would make a recommendation to the council. These grants would not go to the steering committee that Lisa mentioned previously, unless, of course, if we had a number of grants that we received for council planning, we would use the steering committee to help us make any recommendations on that. And then for the comprehensive planning grants, again, this is for land that's already been added to the urban growth boundary, and again, they have to complete the comprehensive planning requirements in our code. Again, these are a little more costly based on the past grants we've had. What we're really trying to do here is make it a little more streamlined in terms of the grant for the comprehensive planning will be part of the growth management decision that the council makes when they add the land to the urban growth boundary. So there wouldn't be a separate separate application process for that. Staff would work with the local jurisdictions prior to the UGB decision to determine the necessary fundings for the comprehensive planning work. And then if the council did make a decision to add land to the urban growth boundary, the would include the award for the grant program within the growth management decision, so we wouldn't have to go through a separate application process. It seems to make a little more sense. And then in both cases, for concept planning and comprehensive planning, the projects must include a community engagement strategy demonstrating best practices for advancing racial equity and involving communities of color in the planning process. So those are generally the changes for proposing for the new urban area planning grants.
Okay. So on the equitable development side of the program, we were thinking as we were looking at how to reframe the program, not just about the kinds of projects that we're funding, but also the process that we're using to determine the grant awards. And so staff are proposing changes to both the process and the types of grants that we awarded. In terms of the process, where we've typically had a several-stage process where communities develop applications from a letter of intent through to a final application, and then the screening committee reviews that, we're going to reduce the amount of upfront work that communities have to do in putting together an application to where they're really going to be presenting, you know, a several-page kind of concept proposal to us. And then we will actually involve the screening committee right off the bat in determining what are the strongest ideas out there. The strongest ideas will be invited in to make a presentation, and then from there, a short list of finalists will be selected. And the idea is then that staff, rather than having those finalists go off and write a more detailed application, Metro staff will actually collaborate with the finalists to fully develop the budget, the scope of work, think about exactly how the project should come together. And we feel like that will be a more successful way for us to work with our partners, and it helps us choose the projects based on the real potential to deliver the outcomes that we're looking for, rather than just basically making a choice based somewhat on how thorough the application was or how well it responded to all the criteria. So we're hopeful about that as a change. In terms of the kinds of things we'll be funding, we're also going to try and focus our efforts on fewer grants so that we can take the time to be that to make time for that collaboration, which we know is kind of an essential part of these community partnerships that advance racial equity. So the two tiers of grants that I'm talking about now are the blue and the red side, this blue section on equitable development. These will be, as I said, fewer projects awarded each year, but hopefully more impactful projects that may take several years to come to fruition. These would be partnerships between local governments and a community partner of some sort. And the project proposal must show how it's both implementing the 2040 growth concept and advancing racial equity, not only through engagement, but through some tangible part of the project that is going to reduce disparities in our communities. So that is a key part of those grants. And then we're envisioning a second track of grants that is really focused on equitable engagement practices and working with our local government partners around the region who are implementing planning projects and funding, providing that additional funding to make sure that we're taking the best approach possible to engagement and really reaching out to our communities of color and other disadvantaged groups. We will be doing that either through funding partnerships with community-based organizations, which is a practice that many of our grantees are currently using as they implement their projects, but we're also going to allow for local jurisdictions to perhaps hire a community liaison from the community to work as part of their staff in implementing a project, because we know that what we're hearing in the community is there's only so many community-based organizations to do this work, and they're getting tapped by a lot of requests to help government partners implement. So we're trying to create many mechanisms through which this work can be done, but the grant funds would really be specifically to fund either the work of those organizations or the community liaisons. These changes that Tim and I have just discussed, they will be going to council for approval in early December. And once they are finalized, we will be trying to get the application materials out to you as soon as possible, hopefully in early January, so that we understand that with these changes, it'll take a while for our government partners to kind of think through their applications and reach out to groups in their community that they may want to partner with. And we'd like to give as much time in the process for next year's schedule to allow those conversations to happen so we get the best ideas. So I think I'll leave it there, and if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
All right, let's open it up for questions and discussion. Does anybody have anything they would like to add or ask?
I had just a definitional question that may have been partly while I was running back and forth trying to pick up a few snacks since I had a pretty light lunch today. You'll have to help me out here on the CET sunset provisions removed.
Dan, could you speak a little
yeah,
bit?
Yeah, sorry. Let me just get it. Could you tell me, I'm sorry, I don't understand, offhand I can't recall what the acronym CET is. Is that better, Peter?
Sorry.
What does it mean to remove that sunset from the Metro Code, and how is that relevant to?
So the projects are funded through a construction excise tax.
The
grants are, and when the construction excise tax was originally put into place in 2006,
right.
There was a sunset provision, and actually, without all the legislation in front of me, I think it was proposed to sunset in 5 years, and then 5 years later it was extended again. And it has finally been removed entirely, that so that the construction excise tax will not sunset, and the tax will move forward so that there are program funds.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Are there any questions? Yes, Danny.
Just a couple. It seemed like some of the last two were new to me. And was that developed with input from the cities and other jurisdictions, or maybe your technical advisory group? Did they come up with those categories and dollar amounts?
We got the feedback from our screening committee, and also we've had informal feedback from a variety of our partners and other grantees who received grants in the past. And so that was sort of the basis on which we've had the equitable development category for a number of years, but we sort of reframed the amount and also added in the requirement now that there be a community partner, because I think it seems to be those projects that are reaching out and where governments are partnered with communities that we're seeing the most impactful and most relevant projects.
So you talked to past recipients and said, how can we make it better? Is that what you did?
Yeah. Well, we have. It's been sort of an informal process, but yes, we've been sort of listening, and we also did go before the committee on Metro's Committee on Racial Equity with this proposal to get their input on how whether they felt that these changes would be helpful.
Okay. Thanks.
I just wanted to express appreciation for one of the changes you're making, which is the idea of selecting your projects based on the idea and the strength of the applicant and then co-creating that application. I think I've been in many grant-making processes, and I wish that other funders would adopt the same approach. I really think it could make a difference, so appreciate that.
That's great. Anyone else? Oh, we've got...
The yellow section, the comprehensive grants for land leasing projects. Are you expecting the four we just did, Wilson Village Road? Are those ones you're expecting now or in this cycle, and then we'll not really see those again until we bring more vans into the urban growth property? Or are you expecting to go back to our?
This was the way it's set up now would be expected as we move forward with any comprehensive planning, an urban growth boundary decision, then the comprehensive planning. Two of the cities who had expansions last year did go through the application process last year in early 2019, and they have funds allocated for them. The other two cities still could do that. Based on that.
So the yellow category, the comprehensive, we're not likely to see
Not in this cycle. It's not expected until the next urban growth boundary decision.
I have a couple of questions. So who is the screening committee? I'm sorry, I don't know this. Is it external, internal?
It's external.
Okay, so what's your criteria for choosing who's on the screening committee?
The criteria are in our administrative rules, but they're essentially it's a nine-person committee, and they are from across the region. They have a variety of backgrounds in development. Some of them work for local parks, housing providers. So we have a real range of expertise, and that's set forth in Metro's in the administrative rules for this program.
It's embedded. It's embedded there.
And they make a recommendation to the Metro COO.
Right, and then the CEO brings it to the board, normal process for approval. So can you give me an example of, I mean, I can think of a few. I think I wrap my head around what equitable development is. Is there something you can point out to us that Metro has helped do that would really be very reflective of that, of a neighborhood or a planning process? Or does anything jump into your head?
Well, we the way we've framed it is we've tried to be somewhat open so that it could either be something that was an area, either a site-specific kind of project, or it could be the planning for a whole area. I would say from our most recent grant cycle, I would note that we've provided funding for the Albina Vision Trust to do Vivant. And that's a partnership with the City of Portland, really. Mm-hmm. Another project in the equitable development category that I think is somewhat similar to projects that we might entertain in the future, although this one was a little bit smaller in nature, but was the what was awarded to the Cully community in conjunction with Prosper Portland. So similar to those, frankly, I know MPAC members heard recently from City of Cornelius about their urban renewal project that they've done, and I think that that's an example of the type of program we'd still want to be able to fund. They, in fact, did partner with Central Cultural, so I think it's not a huge departure, but we are really looking for that collaboration to happen and be fundamental to the way the grant is put together. And I think we're also looking for outcomes in those projects that go beyond just pushing the engagement, but really to be tackling those problems.
So what a project. For example, we've identified in our county, based on a set of metrics that, you know, that what we see are areas of poverty, low income, housing difficulty. So if we had a project of renewals, of a community renewal plan, something like that would be eligible for. And the fact that we have identified specific areas where we think the work needs, you know, what needs to be done, that would be kind of the kind of project we would present to you.
Yes, and what you'd want to do is really think through who are the communities that are going to be impacted,
right,
and who are the natural partners that you might invite to join with, you know, with the county.
Okay. One of our issues that we worry about is, again, when we revitalize communities, gentrification happens, and we were very successful as a county, and I'll just brag a little bit here, when we were working with an Overland Park group, which is one of our pockets. We actually revitalized the community, but it was intentional not to gentrify. So we did roads, we had sewer hookups, a large urban area, which was all, you know, septic tanks that were leaking and causing a problem. So those kinds of construction things, too, would be eligible for something like this? Or?
The planning for a project like that.
All right. Anyone else? Sorry, I don't want to suck the air out of you. Okay. Well, let's move on. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
So let's move on to the affordable housing bond implementation and communication. Transportation funding. I'm getting ahead of ourselves here. And so this is really going to be Andy Shaw, Metro Government Affairs and Policy Development Director, Margie Bradway, Metro Deputy Director of Planning and Development, And basically in June, Metro staff provided an update on their work with jurisdictional partners and the community to develop this potential measure. And today you're back to show us some highlights of that, what we've done so far. So welcome.
Good evening. Thanks for having us back. Andy Shaw, Director of Government Affairs at Metro. So yes, we were here in June to provide an update on where we are. Great. We're trying to get this map in there. This is a map you all should know well, the 2040 growth concept. It's the place we start with the work we're doing on transportation and housing and parks and other our other initiatives. Want to point out, though, that the main point of this growth concept developed back and approved back in the 1990s was to identify the places we're going to grow, the centers, the town centers, the employment areas, and how they're connected by corridors. And so corridors is a key component of the discussion that we're having with our transportation task force. But all of that, all the work we're doing to develop this transportation measure comes from the beginning of our land use. So I want to just connect that tonight, and we've got some new maps tonight to show you about how we believe the transportation work is connecting into our land use. So back in 2017, the Metro Council directed staff to move forward with a regional investment strategy, which was looking at that great growth concept, how do we actually make the investments that realize a lot of the goals that we have as a region as we grow? You know that we're facing immense amounts of growth. We talk about in recent years, we've had as many as 100 folks a day moving here. That's a TriMet busload of folks coming into the region every day just to do the social math. Immense growth that affects our congestion, affordability, use of our parks, all the things that we value and cherish about the region. And so to maintain the quality of life as we grow, knowing that growth is coming, the Metro Council said, let's go forth and try to find ways to really invest in the things we care about as a region. So you heard earlier, just a very successful Parks and Nature Bond measure at the election last week. A year ago, the housing bond passed. We're working with all of our jurisdictional partners to get that going. We already have about 10% of the units identified through a phase one process and are in the process of advancing intergovernmental agreements to get the remaining resources out the door. But really here, we're here to talk about the transportation measure and development of a measure for 2020. So I think this is your slide on...
We're going to go back and forth here.
Yeah.
Hi, and again, I'm Margie Bradway. I'm the Deputy Director of the Planning Development Department, where I oversee a lot of the transportation functions of the Planning Department. So the measure, the transportation measure, has been a partnership with Government Relations, and one of the things that we did in the Planning Department, as you may remember, if you've been on MPAC for a while, you've seen many of Kim Ellis's presentations on the Regional Transportation Plan. Not only did the Regional Transportation Plan identify and develop many policies and areas of need of investment, but identified projects. And so we had $42 billion of projects identified as part of our Regional Transportation Plan. That's over $1 million of projects, and that's only on the constrained list. The RTP is updated every 4 to 5 years. The RTP really set the foundation for going into this measure. And if you recall, we did outreach and we got input from over 19,000 people on the Regional Transportation Plan. So this was it confirmed that there's a big need in our region, and B, it confirmed that there's a multimodal need, as you can see from this chart, in the region.
So we started off this work with a great foundation of the most recently adopted Regional Transportation Plan, which included, I believe, the first ever active transportation plan as a part of the RTP. Also, the region's Climate Smart Plan and Metro's strategy to advance racial equity. So all those form sort of the basis of the conversation about how to develop a transportation measure. Our council gave us direction to bring forward priority corridor projects, and we'll talk about this in just a second. We've worked with the task force to identify the highest priority projects. We call those Tier 1 corridors. We had another list of Tier 2 corridors and even a third list of Tier 3 corridors. All of these were identified through a pretty hefty process of data analysis and examination and also discussion of growth where growth is going to occur, discussion of needs throughout the region with the task force and the council last spring. I'm actually going to skip this one because we cover it a little bit in the timeline. Again, the basis of the of all our work is the region's transportation plan. We've done a serious amount of engagement through the process of developing the measure, from engagement last spring with community organizations, a survey instrument that had 3,500 responses around programs and corridors, the kinds of priorities people would want to see addressed in those corridors. We took the corridors to local investment teams over the course of the summer, so residents who use these corridors responding to project concepts on those corridors over the summertime, and Metro's funding community partnerships with organizations that represent communities of color to make sure those voices are a part of the process. So the timeline. Spoke a little bit about the corridor development process. In through the spring, after developing out the values and goals that the council and the task force wanted to see addressed in this transportation measure, used a pretty heavy data-driven process, and we'll do a quick review of the some of the maps and some of the data that we brought to that process. But through that process, identified 13 top tier one corridors. And there's a tiny little box right there below the second bubble that is the local investment teams. They met over the summer looking at those 13 corridors and all the projects coming out of the regional transportation plan, also some other concepts of what we look at a whole corridor, what could you do along this corridor that's maybe in addition to what's in the RTP. They looked at all that. In the meantime, the task force worked on developing regional program concepts and forwarded that to the council, and the council's narrowed that to 9 program concept areas. We'll get to that towards the end of the presentation. We then are bringing these priority corridors with the projects back to the task force right now. They're in the midst, they're in between two discussion meetings to talk about the projects, the balance of projects around the region, the modes and the focus of the investments in those areas. We will then move on to the much easier discussion about how do we pay for this transportation measure in the December and January timeframe, trying to match up sort of the list of projects, the outcomes we're trying to achieve in these corridors and with the program concepts with the types of resources that are legally available to the region and the legal uses of those resources and how high we think we can scale those resources to match the appetite for funding. And in the spring, we are scheduled to talk to ensure that we have the correct type of oversight and accountability mechanisms in the measure, and the goal is to be able to bring the Metro Council a measure they could refer in the May timeframe to put it on the 2020 ballot. So the council early on in the year appointed a 35-member task force. Some of representatives from this table, some representatives from the JPAC table, other elected officials, in addition to community members, business leaders, folks that are involved in the transportation sector. It was a very deliberate effort to put all those interests and voices at the same table, because when we go to the ballot, we'll be talking to a broad array of people, and so making sure all those voices are represented in the process of developing recommendations for the council to consider advancing a measure we felt was very important. They've had 13 meetings so far, three more to go before the end of the year, and a lot more work in the new year. So thanks especially to the members here who are on the task force and the other members of the task force for all the work that they're doing. This, I think we reviewed this with you last time. There's a pretty lengthy list of goals to as outcomes to come out of the measure, to achieve in the measure. This is a very high-level summary, and online on our website is a 3-page, I think, document that lays out some of the more context around these goals, but addressing access to transit, safety, climate, resiliency are the flavors of things that the council and the task force asked us to try to consider as we develop this transportation measure. So let's we go to Adam Helper. Thank you, Ernie. We wanted to jump out of the PowerPoint for just a second and show you some of the interactive maps that were part of the basis that the task force used to look at data. When we looked at prioritizing corridors, we brought information about congestion rates, about access to transit, about transit delay, about regulated affordable housing along various corridors. safety issues, safety rates of crashes along corridors, what we call out of the RTP, the equity focus areas. Lots of different ways of thinking about when you want to prioritize these corridors. So you can just imagine all these map layers showing up on the screen right now. It was a way to have. Yeah, I'm gonna dance in just a minute. We're gonna yeah. It was a way to really have the task force look at all the different factors that they could in prioritizing these different corridors. So you can click on the top and bring forth different layer map layers and overlay that with the corridors we had. You may recall
this one's affordable housing, just to know what they're looking at.
This is regulated affordable housing. There's youth, expected growth. H&T is the housing and transportation burden. So showing what people are faced with in terms of overall costs of housing and transportation. So lots of data to try to think about if we're making investments in these major corridors, what variety of interests are we advancing? And I would encourage you to go to the site and explore it some more yourself. The main point is here, the task force really worked hard to think about the variety of things that we're trying to achieve in advancing these corridors. Okay, maybe we can switch back now to the... So in addition to the task force's work to narrow to these corridors, the green corridors are the Tier 1 corridors that were advanced to the local investment teams. The gold or yellow corridors are the Tier 2 corridors. And I'll just make a note, we did a lot of work around these Tier 1 corridors to examine the projects on them. We've also opened the opportunity for local jurisdictions to propose advancing a Tier 2 corridor, and the task force will get to that in the February timeframe after we had a chance to talk about the overall revenue and how much investment capacity is there for the measure. So as I discussed earlier, after that corridor prioritization, we invited 31 individuals to in the three different counties to examine these, go on tours. A lot of folks went on those tours. I think it's still true that Councilor Lewis is in all of these pictures. She attended many of the tours. Appreciation for all those of you who were able to come out on the tours. It was a great opportunity to get out and see the place, experience in some cases the congestion, see the trains and things. Shutting down traffic near TV Highway and on Southwest 185th, et cetera. But then we had our Kittleson, our engineer, go through the project concepts with folks and get evaluative feedback from them. And all that came to the task force in 30 pages of reports and a verbal presentation to the task force members from folks selected by the local investment teams. We also recently held forums in each of the counties, over 200 people attending the three different conversations, panel presentations, boards that talked about the various project concepts in these corridors, lots of good interaction and a little bit of socialization and fun at the same time. So how do all these corridors connect into our land use plan? This is a representation of the Tier 1 corridors that we're most actively talking about. And, of course, they link into the central city, which is the planned most dense area in the region. They also link to all of these specific regional centers, places that our region and our local governments have agreed we're going to also concentrate some significant growth of housing and jobs, employment, commercial activity. They also link to town centers throughout the region, which are more like the main streets that people go to shop, but not quite as intense a level of development as our regional centers or the downtown. And lastly, connect into employment areas where there are either already very robust job and employment areas or places that we plan to have employment and job growth in the near future. And this matches up pretty well with, you may have seen a different image of what I call the octopus. This is a representation of how people move around the region. So the corridors we've selected, the kinds of investment we're making, do match up pretty well with how we know people move around the region to get from home to work. The significant takeaway, I think, from this lower left corner box is a lot of people leave the county they live in to go to work, and they go to many other places to do that. It's just a reality of how people travel and get around the region. Okay, now back to Mark.
Okay. So you may have read in the news that a couple weeks ago we came out with our initial staff recommendation on the Tier 1 corridors. And what when we say the kind of staff project recommendation, we're really starting to get to what are we going to do on these tiers. And that energy and focus was on the Tier 1, which was advanced by the task force. And what we did was work very closely with our partners, a lot of our partners in this room, represented by staff in this room and leadership in this room, to lay out all the maps and roll up our sleeves and say, what could we do on this corridor to get the performance that we want? What is the performance-based design? You may have heard President Peterson at one point talk about practical design, performance-based design, but that's really taking the outcomes, whether they're identified by the T20 task force and or Metro Council, and saying, what are the engineering concepts and really kind of complete street concepts we could do on these corridors to better meet those outcomes. So we took those outcomes, we took the input from the LIT teams and the LIT teams in the counties. Some LIT teams were as general as we want to reduce traffic deaths, and some were as specific as we really like that project or we really don't like that project. And we kind of tried to take that information as a whole and use it as a guide. And then we also looked at all the potential projects through the lens of kind of readiness or risk. And based on that, we identified over $5 million, let's see, of need. Is that in here?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So we identified $5.24 billion, make sure that's a with B, need on those top corridors. From those, we then said we suggested this time that part of the transportation measure, $3.11 billion, should go forward to fund these projects. And this is all online. There's really beautiful, nice maps that kind of show you this. And a lot of the themes in those projects, I would say that if I was to say two kind of overarching themes on all the corridors were transit investments and safety investments. What we heard was a lot of people want to see transit investments, in particular buses, and buses go faster. So there's a lot of projects proposed that are types of what's called enhanced transit investments. You also hear it called better bus, but how do we get buses to have the priority move faster? I think there was little disagreement that traffic safety is universally important, and our polling shows that as well. And then there's also an interest to make sure that we were planning and doing for planning and setting ourselves up for the bigger moves. So the LIT teams were very specific, for example, on McLaughlin, that they wanted us to make improvements on McLaughlin, but they also wanted us to study the likelihood in the future of extending the Orange Line. So we actually propose money for both. We can make short-term investment in the 1 to 5 year, but we can put money in kind of what I would call the 10-year bucket to continue expanding our MAX line. And this is also true for things like the MAX tunnel study, if you've read or heard about that. And next slide. Thanks, Andy. So here's just some takeaways. There's a breakdown to show that we connect 18 regional centers. We're proposing in transit a $1.92 billion of transit. We're estimating at this time, at the preliminary engineering stage, that we would save 975 hours of transit time by accelerating the bus system. Of the areas we're proposing to invest in, $2.3 billion of that is in areas identified as equity areas in the RTP. And we would address 20% of the region's serious crashes.
Back to me.
Okay.
So I'm skipping that one. So just to follow on, this is a map of the racial, the equity areas, which is both communities of color and limited English proficiency and low income, right? It's all three combined?
Yes. That's right.
And how it compares to, again, the Tier 1 and Tier 2 corridors. There's been a strong focus on racial equity, and one of the major takeaways has been we want to make significant investments in the region, but we don't want to cause displacement as a result of that. And so the proposal that's emerged out of that is to actually copy the practice that was used in the Southwest Corridor, the Southwest Equitable Development process, to bring folks together, talk about how do we identify the kinds of displacement-type impacts that could occur, and what do we do about that? What are the other investments we can make in housing, in small business stabilization, other approaches? So we're proposing putting 2% of the budget for each corridor there to run a similar process in these major corridor investment areas and actually fund some of the things that come out of that that process to identify ways of reducing the displacement effects of making an investment and increasing the values in an area. We don't know of any other region or area that's taken an approach quite like this to get ahead of displacement as we look at major transportation and transit investments. So schedule going forward, we've got a work session before the Metro Council to make sure they're fully up to date on the Tier 1 projects, although they're tracking very closely and we've been giving them lots of briefings. The task force meets again in its regular meeting next week to continue the discussion about the Tier 1 corridor projects. We are actually adding another meeting at the request of the task force on December 11th, which I know conflicts with MPEC, so apologies for that. But we will be holding that meeting not here because MPAC's here, so at an offsite. So I know that creates a conflict for some of the members who are on both. Apologies. We will have the beginning of the revenue discussion at that meeting, and then use the December 18th meeting that was already scheduled to ask the task force to advance recommendations to the Metro Council. So we slid a little bit in our calendar, but I think the good news is the task force is very, very engaged. They really want to talk with one another about these various. How do you balance all these different priorities in looking at the investments in the corridors they've advanced? In the first few weeks of January, we'll bring the recommendations to the Metro Council. We are looking at holding a public hearing in the evening in early January. We'll get those dates out to folks when we have a look at time and location. But making sure that the Metro Council can hear from the broader public. The task force has had a lot of testimony from the public and heard a lot of input. We want to make sure that the council, the folks have an opportunity to share that kind of input with the Metro Council as well. And then we have two more task force meetings, continuing the revenue discussion in mid-January and on to potential Tier 2 projects in the February timeframe. So the other area beyond corridors is programs. And I think we talked a little bit with you back in June, but the concept of establishing annual funding programs outside of corridor-specific, place-specific investments is there's a broader array of things we want to accomplish with investments in transportation that can't all be dealt with in these specific corridors. So we proposed a set of programs that could be in the $5 to $10 million range. We started out saying it should be about 5 to 6 programs. We're at 9 now, so a little challenge to figure out how we fit all that within in the similar kind of budget. These could be investments in capital, investments in non-capital, and we'll get to the list that the council has advanced. But they're meant to advance the broader outcomes that the task force and the council have set forth. So here are the 9 programs that out of work with the task force, a lot of community engagement. The council asked us to continue exploring. They include investments in safe routes to schools, investments in active transportation connections. We know with our active transportation plan, actually my talking points are old on this because before the parks measure passed, it was going to take us 200 years to build out the active transportation plan. We'll have to revise that based on the funding that's now available through the parks bond measure. And if we're able to put this together and pass a transportation measure, it will also shorten that from 200 years to something more like in our lifetimes to build out this active transportation network. We're exploring the area of making the bus and TriMet system more affordable to youth and students. We're proposing a safety hotspots program, which could fund areas outside the corridors of specific focus, where we know there are safety issues and where safety issues arise in the future. Bus electrification, this is a key component of getting ahead of our climate challenge. This would provide money to TriMet to advance their process of purchasing electric vehicles and bring much closer in time the date at which they could say we're never buying a diesel bus again. We know that diesel buses are actually one of the largest source of diesel particulate emissions in the region. We have a multifamily housing concept we want to advance to look at transit-oriented development in the region and along these corridors. The Better Bus is sort of a program that Margie talked about a little bit, but outside these corridors, are there places we can make spot investments to help transit move through congestion, move through corridors more readily? The Main Streets concept is there are smaller streets and downtown routes that are very important to many of our cities. They don't rise to the level of regional arterials, but they're still places that we should look to make investments to help pedestrians get to shopping, to make them places that people want to get to. And then prior future corridor funding, this is back to the concept of on an ongoing basis to have resources available to be prepared for state funding, federal funding, or maybe future measures. Would help us with some of the challenges we've had in developing this measure, that we may have concepts or we may identify problems, but we're not always ready with the planned solutions for the funding when funding becomes available. We've talked a lot. That's a high-level overview of all the work of the task force and staff and community here. Be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you for that, because I know we've all been watching this for a while, and we appreciate the update. So let's open it up for questions or comments. Okay, Rachel.
Thank you for the presentation. We've been definitely keeping up with this as it's moved along. Could you tell me, are you planning to open up the idea of new Tier 2 projects since they're being considered a little bit later? Or do you consider that window closed? The projects kind of needed to come in this summer.
So we've asked local jurisdictions that would like to advance Tier 2 projects to provide us a set of information that helps us identify risk, helps us identify partners that they would need, like ODOT, TriMet, others who are involved would need to be involved in those corridors, and that date has now passed. We've gotten, I think, 6 proposals for advancing Tier 2 corridors. I mean, in general, the part of the reason that Tier 1 corridors advanced has to do with readiness and a lower amount of risk, that if we say with this amount of money we can achieve this project, that risk is pretty low, whereas many Tier 2 corridors were places where we know there's a problem, we know there's a challenge, but the work to develop the solution and is not as advanced, so the risk of saying for this amount of money we could actually deliver this project is higher. That tended to separate out some of those. Plus, just a sense of regionalism and looking around, how do we make sure we're touching lots of communities in the region with this investment? But that tended to be part of what separated out Tier 1 and Tier 2. There's no magic line, and so we've said, let's open the door to examine some of these Tier 2. We've gotten six proposals, and we'll bring those to the task force and do more work with the jurisdictions in those projects between now and then.
Which is great, but just to clarify, you're not accepting new outside of the 6?
No.
Correct.
Thank you.
Andy, can you list some of what those 6 are?
Sure.
99W.
Yep.
Highway 43.
Correct. Aglo Bridge or
the Willamette Crossing, I think.
Was put forward. So those are 2 from Clackamas County and 4 from Washington County.
So a transit-related concept on 26.
Yep, a 217 project and then a kind of a northern connector-ish concept.
Yeah.
Some of the 4, I would say definitely the 2 from Clackamas County are, I would say, a little bit farther along in the project conception phase, ready to kind of move into project development. Politics aside, I'm just saying from a technical standpoint, the 4 received from Washington County tend to lean better towards needs more study, needs more planning money.
Which is in many cases what they requested.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't get any proposals from Multnomah County, Portland, Gresham, that area.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Yes, Mark.
I'm guessing the $5.24 billion for Tier 1 doesn't make it fixed, right?
Yeah.
What pretty good.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of discussion of, what's transformative? What are we trying to do? And that really kind of depends on how the lens in which you look at the objective that you're trying to achieve. Someone may look at a roadway and say, as long as I know there's going to be no fatalities and no injuries on this roadway, I don't care how fast I'm driving. This is just through one person's eyes. That's success, right? Another person may look at that exact same roadway and say, as long as I can get through during the commute hour in 20 minutes, that's my version of success. So we try to meet multiple objectives, and there are times and there are engineering treatments where we can achieve those multiple objectives. There's actually one when you kind of take a lane or partial lane for a bus. If you do it in a certain way, you can reduce the pedestrian crossing so that you're actually improving transit and improving pedestrian safety. So we look for those moments, but sometimes it's a trade-off of outcomes. For the 5 million, that there were some roadways like 82nd and TV Highway where we looked at the package of investments that we either knew through the RTP or were put forward by the jurisdictions, and we mostly suggested funding it. I said, yeah, do it. But there was other ones that maybe had a fit that was, say there was a roadway where they proposed expanding a four-way intersection to an eight-way intersection. And we looked at that and said, it's kind of doesn't fit. These turning movements, while we understand you might need them, may not fit the objectives or the things that we heard from that Lit Committee RT 2020. So, and we do have roadway projects, to be clear, but there were just some things that were proposed that didn't seem to fit the outcomes that the task force met. So that's what really the lens in which we looked at that.
I would say just another theme in here is this theme of partnership. The stance that Metro Council took at the beginning of the year was that the best place for us to try to focus regional resources is on these major regional arterials, and that we don't want to take the space of the expectation that the state and the federal government will continue to invest in the interstate highway system. So that's one sort of attempt at partnership. We all went down to Salem and worked on the 2017 transportation package, got a $5.3 billion transportation package passed, got a lot of things that we were looking for. We were hoping for a larger investment from the state than we ended up getting, but got a lot of investments that were directed at this region, a first ever statewide transit funding, so lots of elements that helped us move forward. Now the question is, how does this measure? And understanding what voters might want to approve, how does this measure partner with those resources, and how can we be smart and strategic about federal resources? So this $3.1 billion would pair with what we expect is $2.1 billion in matching funds, either federal funds or other identified funds. For example, the Burnside Bridge has an identified other sources of funding that some of these investments would match with, to get us to $5.2 billion in total investment between the proposed measure resources and the potential matching funds. But we're trying to identify those things that are the most appropriate for the region to step up and fund, while recognizing others have... We still expect the state to fund these interstate systems. We still expect the federal government to continue funding these interstate routes.
So are we hoping for some revolution? So it seems like we're making incremental progress where we can, balancing the objectives. Is there some revolutionary concept we can hope for that makes it so we have safe roads and expedited travel? Like, what is it? Is it technological improvement? Is it more bus lanes?
We're not
nibbling away at incremental improvement and revolutionize transportation. Or is that just...
No, I think we're trying to do a little bit of both. One thing I think that Andy was kind of alluding to, you may notice that top of our three corridors, McLaughlin, 82nd, and TV Highway, have been owned by ODOT forever. And there has been a long history of disinvestment in the arterial system, and those resources were routed to the interstate system. And so even to do kind of the basics, even to make buses go faster on 82nd, we have to grapple with the state of repair issues. And we have to kind of, I joked with a colleague working on this. I said, I can build a Hyperloop on 82nd, but it doesn't matter if people are dying underneath it, right, as they're trying to access it. So, part of this is we have to deal with the core transportation issues. People want to see potholes fixed. People want sidewalks. People want lighting. That's what our polling is telling us. That's what our lit teams told us. So we've got to do that. But can we do some innovative things? Yes. I think the innovation really in this package is about all the areas where we're looking to expedite the bus system. And when one of the things I've talked a little bit about taking a lane here and there, but it's called TSP, Transit Signal Priority. That really, City of Portland is starting to do this in key places. If this measure passes, it's going to be all over the region where buses are going to be talking to our streetlights, and the lights will change as the buses approach. And there'll be less kind of in traffic and opportunities to jump kind of in an intersection. And, you know, if you map that all over the region, I think that is going to be the transformative thing. It'll be built in increments, but together it'll be a huge system improvement.
Add one more layer of sort of transformative partnership, which is our partnership with ODOT. Community folks have worked for decades to try to get jurisdictional transfer of some of these state highways.
Yeah.
And in this dialogue, we've moved beyond that. The Oregon Transportation Commission has directed Region 1 to work with partners in this region where we make investments in those state highways. We're going to use urban design standards. And that totally changes the – none of what Margie just described could you have done on a state highway without that change. It's subtle, and it's not been out there in the news media, but it's a really important new partnership for us and the state to actually take what their old state highways, they function as urban arterials, and to treat them as urban arterials and look at bus and look at traffic and safety on those places from an urban point of view will make a big difference in people's lives.
Dick?
Just to kind of talk a little more about the bus piece. You've given us a couple of fairly specific examples, and there was the illustration of the bus lane. Do we have any? You've mentioned briefly the signal priority is going on in Portland. I wasn't aware of that, and that's great. I've been on the sort of bus rapid transit light that they have down in Eugene. And not that I've seen real bus rapid transit in China, but are there more local examples that we have? I'm particularly interested in really seeing some substantial reduction in amount of travel time for people on buses between Forest Grove, Cornelius, Hillsboro, Aloha, Beaverton.
Yeah.
Those are long travel times, and if we could trim those by 15 or 20%, that would make a huge difference in the quality of service and make a big difference in the communities.
Yeah, great question. And Eugene's system is fantastic. In fact, it's one of the best BRT systems, bus rapid transit systems in the entire nation.
Yeah.
The other nearby location that's been investing in bus rapid transit is our friends to the north. Clark County has really started. If you go to downtown Vancouver, they have some really great BRT investments.
Okay.
BRT is kind of the, if you think of enhanced transit corridors as a spectrum, and you think of changing a signal timing as the low end of the spectrum, the low cost but effective treatment, bus rapid transit is kind of the extreme other end of
the gold standard.
The gold standard, right?
Don't use the word extreme.
Yes. Not extreme, yeah. Extreme, sorry.
And then if you see what you see in China, then you realize
that what we do
in Eugene is pretty modest
thank
stuff,
you.
Actually.
Yes. Yeah. The gold standard, thank you. And we are exploring that treatment. I would say somewhere in between, I would say maybe not in the middle, but over here is our articulated bus system that gives right-of-way in key places. That's really what the Division Transit Project is. It's not quite BRT, but the articulated buses are longer and quicker, and there's going to be more space allocated for them in Division. That's in Portland. That project is in construction right now. It'll be completed by the end of this calendar year.
You're calling it articulated?
Articulated buses. It's a bigger bus.
Oh, those are those longer ones. Those are the longer ones.
Carry people.
Yeah, okay.
And the stops, the start and the stops, you have to have more dedicated space. So not only are the buses bigger, but the area of movement is bigger. So while they may not have taken an entire lane all the way down, there's huge chunks kind of dedicated for these big buses to pull in and out. You'll see that on Division. For two of our top corridors, 82nd Avenue and TV Highway, we are exploring all of those big investments. So BRT is on the table for TV Highway. It is also on the table for 82nd. We probably will not have that design decision finished by referral, mostly because we think there's an opportunity to leverage federal transport, FTA funding, federal funding. And so for federal funding, you have to go through an EIS process where you move several scenarios forward. So we're looking at those more gold standard treatments for our big arterials.
But I think the message is we want to be prepared through this measure, if we can, to actually draw down federal funds and go as far as building the gold standard of BRT on some of these key corridors.
And just one last follow-up on what you just said. Could you tell me a little more specifically what the sort of legal or administrative rulemaking or whatever it was that ODOT has taken with respect to District 1, their District 1, to think more creatively and to think more of these as urban roads and not just state highways?
Well, it's not a rulemaking, but it was a conversation. They had started what they call the Blueprint for Urban Design. They also call it BUD. They had started a draft process on urban design guidelines internally. The idea with these urban design guidelines were to be in replace of the Highway Design Manual, HDM, where applied. In the meantime, Metro was working on our urban design standard at the same time. And so President Peterson and I approached ODOT leadership and we said, we really, you know, if we fund these, we'd really like to use our urban design standards. And they said, well, we're working on our own. We said, why don't you use our measure as the pilot for your urban design standards? And they said, that's a great idea. Okay. So they haven't yet adopted. I think we're on a path to adopt this blueprint for urban design across the state. We hope so, but we were kind of we'll be first out of the gate as your pilot.
Is that something that the Oregon Transportation Commission would have the power to do without any further legislative actions or whatever?
And frankly, there was a lot of leadership with ODOT's new director, Chris Strickler, there, who was instrumental in giving that direction to Region 1.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? I have a resiliency question, however, because one of the things that we've been thinking of in our county, for example, is, you know, if in the event of something like a Cascadian event, mm-hmm. we know that we're going to have to, a pathway from Central Oregon or from the east to the west is critical. Where in the Tier 1 projects is that addressed anywhere? Because it's not just our county, but it'll be a corridor for the whole area.
Mm-hmm. One of the data layers we looked at was the routes that have been identified as routes in and out of the region in the event of an emergency, and the bridges along those routes. Frankly, there aren't very many of those bridges that have had planning occur to get them to the place that we could propose a project, with one major exception, which is the Burnside Bridge.
Right.
And the Burnside Bridge has been identified as a key regional lifeline, partly because of the length of Burnside beyond the bridge actually has very few other bridges that could fall during an event like mm-hmm. that. So it when you connect the bridge across the river, it creates a lifeline for the entire region from east to west and over the Willamette River. So that is the one major project that's a specific resiliency focus. Of course, improving other roadways that include areas that you're bridging a gulf or a gap will help build those to a standard that's better than the current construction.
Okay, thank you for that. The other thing I would like to ask is this. One of the things, and I've talked to Ernie about this and staff, is that can we frame perhaps when we have our next meeting a little bit more of what the land use policies are as we work with these corridors? Because, you know, upzoning, downzoning, how do you manage your land mass so again, you're creating housing and all those kinds of things, and particularly with the intention of keeping communities intact. How is that land use nexus? I really, before I leave in this role, I'd like to have a more in-depth discussion of the land use practices of successful corridors.
I think that's a great topic, and I will say that there are several of what we call kind of our major corridors, including the investment package, where we recommend further corridor planning. And so there will be places, and Metro will work with the local jurisdiction to do that for further planning, frankly, like the, I mentioned, McLaughlin. That won't just be looking at the Orange Line, but that will be looking at the full suite of things along that corridor, what it takes to make that a livable community with land use and transportation. So I think that's a good topic to come back on. I just wanted to let you know that we have funds allocated on some corridors to do an in-depth study in that space.
And but I'll ask staff to see if we can have a deeper discussion. Hopefully, okay. Our next meeting we can add something on. But thank
maybe
you.
Please engage in that. Yeah.
That answer that would really be good. And I will remind you, however, McLaughlin, they foment rebellion out there. I think Mark will agree with me sometimes too. That's going to be a challenge, but we'll be there to help out. I know
we were really pleasantly surprised with the very, very positive feedback we got from the local investment team, where it was a really interesting blend of different interests and different priorities.
Oh, yeah.
And through dialogue amongst those folks, even you know, the guy representing freight came around to saying, actually, my top priority is safety and mobility on McLaughlin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a really interesting
safety
process and dialogue.
Safety is a huge issue there, yeah. And a lot of land that could be redeveloped. But I digress. We need to go. Thank you so much
for having us.
You.
Yes.
Great update. So let's move into our final conversation. And that is the Affordable Housing Bond Implementation and Communications update. And we'll hear from Emily Lieb, Metro Housing Bond Program Manager. And there you are. Okay. And then we'll, following that, the Housing Policy Program Manager, Jess Larson, will provide a brief summary of the recent public opinion research. So, again, this is informational, but important informational we need to have to move forward. So, thank you. Ladies.
Thank you, Chair Schrader. Hello, good evening, everyone. I'm Jess Larson with Metro's Housing Team. I want to introduce Valeria Vidal for you all. She recently joined our team and is working alongside of Emily and I and others to help get the Housing Bond Program up and running. And Emily is at home sick tonight, so happy to have Valeria here to provide this update to you.
Yes, thank you so much for having us. We're very excited to be here with you tonight and share all the work that we've been doing. As I understand, Metro staff last presented an update to you guys in February of this year. So we're here to share what progress we have made since then. Really exciting progress. In November of last year, as you remember, voters in all three countries passed two measures on the ballot to issue $652.8 million in bonds to fund affordable housing, and for these to be owned by non-public entities and be leveraged with other traditional tools such as the low-income tax credit. In the measure, affordable housing is defined as land and improvements for residential units occupied by low-income households making 80% or less of area median income. The seven eligible implementation partners of the bonds are the ones shown in the slide. Plus Metro's own site acquisition program. Metro Council adopted a framework with the bond referral and the distribution of targets and funds are shown in the screen. These targets are the absolute top priority of the program and are outcomes that we need to achieve to follow through our commitments to voters. So since the spring, eligible implementation jurisdictions have conducted extensive and really thorough and great community engagement to inform their creation of their local implementation strategies, also known and be referred to during the presentation as LIS. Each LIS includes a development plan to achieve the local share of unit production targets and strategies for advancing racial equity and ensuring inclusive community engagement throughout the implementation in the next 5 to 7 years. Each project selected by a local partner will be reviewed by Metro staff to confirm consistency with LIS. For implementation schedule, from January 2019 to June, Metro Council approved phase 4-1 projects parallel to the LIS development that was being done by our local jurisdictions. Since July, our oversight committee has reviewed local implementation strategies,
7 of 8 plans have been approved and recommended to Metro Council. And then we are just now starting the work with approving IGAs, which will include the LISs of the jurisdictions. This will be reviewed by Council starting November 21st of this month. Following IGA approvals, local jurisdictions will begin issuing competitive solicitations for project proposals to compete for bond funding. We have two IGAs scheduled, November 21st, like I said, and then one in December. And we wanted to congratulate Mayor Doyle, who's not here anymore, but actually last night, Beaverton City Council approved to invest general fund in new home ownership programming, as well as approving the IGA with Metro. So we just want to give him a little shout out. Our oversight committee. So in February, Metro Council appointed a community oversight committee, currently 12 members, to support Metro's primary role in regional accountability and oversight of our Metro bonds. The group's first SAC, and they have been working very hard at this, meeting almost monthly during the past 8 months, has been to review and recommend, with considerations if needed, implementation strategies created by each partner for council approval. Once the program is fully up and running, so after February, once City of Portland gets their LIS reviewed, the committee's role will be to monitor, report, and recommend implementation improvements to Metro Council. So on to some exciting concrete fun projects. Phase one projects, like I mentioned, these were already approved, pre-approved by Metro Council. Between March and July, each local implementation partner had the opportunity to submit a project to be considered for Metro approval. Metro Council provided early commitments to four phase one projects, seen in the slide. The goal really was to support early project concepts to ensure speedy responses to the housing crisis while also providing time for thoughtful community-based planning to shape implementation. So right now, there's already community engagement activities happening for the four of these projects. As you can see, we have one in Beaverton, one from the Housing Authority of Clackamas County, one for Home Forward, and one for the Housing Authority of Washington County. And this really summarizes concrete progress that we've made. This is our phase one project dashboard and how we're tracking towards our goals. It's available on Metro's Housing website. We think it's a lot for the little time that we've had to get this program up and running. And our next steps are our partners developing their RFPs and NOFAs, and we anticipate those starting in the winter of 2020 for additional projects. So I'll pass it on to Jess to continue, and I'm happy to take questions at the end.
Thanks, Valeria. So in anticipation of these four projects and the many more to come, the 3,900 homes that the bond will fund are anticipated to be created through about 40 to 50 projects across the region. And that's a lot of work in our community to be responding and bringing supportive conversations to our local communities about these new affordable housing communities. So we worked with our partners at DHM and their annual housing panel survey they run every April to ask if they would do some additional public opinion research to understand how voters in our region not only feel about an affordable housing bond investment, we know the answer to that thanks to the November 2018 election, but how they feel about affordable homes specifically in their neighborhood. You are all in community meetings regularly through your work, hearing about urgent demands for affordable housing and also nervousness and questions and confusions around new development and certain kinds of housing types. And so we wanted to figure out where voters were generally as it pertains to affordable housing specifically in their neighborhood so that you could anticipate these conversations better in your communities. So real quickly, background on that research. This is, as I said, an annual survey. Actually, DHM does a monthly panel questionnaire on various topics all throughout the year. And so the May survey is specifically about housing issues. And so we asked them to ask these additional questions for participants in the Portland metro area. Wanting to understand, again, where they stood. This is just a repeat of what I've just explained. So here we are. That was 430 residents in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, and with an estimated error then, margin of error of 4.7%. So a good sense of where voters in our region are at on this issue. And as I mentioned, you'll remember that voters supported the 2018 bond measure with 59% support and passing in all three counties. And the good news from this panel research with DHM is that support from the bond is consistent with how voters feel specifically about affordable housing in their neighborhood. So when we ask them, do you agree or disagree with the statement, I support building more affordable housing in my neighborhood, we found that 61% of voters agreed that they would support more affordable housing specifically in their neighborhood. We wanted to learn a little bit more about that nature of that support and messages. Pardon me for the small print here in this slide, but this is an item that I believe was included in your packet. I think it's the very last item, and these messages are there for you to take and utilize, because the good news is these are all messages that resonate with voters. So voters agree that creating more housing options creates shelter for those in need and helps to make our neighborhoods safe and enjoyable for all. They also agree that it feels good to know that my neighborhood includes residents of all incomes. This was a kind of a surprising result for me, how personal the issue is for voters, really resonating with that notion that the diversity of income levels in an individual's neighborhood matters. Also, voters think that all neighborhoods in the region share a responsibility in creating affordable housing, a 66% overall support there. And then finally, our region is changing as more people move here, which means the character of some of our neighborhoods will also have to change as we make room. Another message that sometimes we think can trigger some anxiety and frustration, but actually generates 63% of voter support. So we're seeing generally that there are a lot of reasons why voters agree affordable housing in their neighborhood is a good and desirable thing, and these are all messages that you can bring into those community conversations. We were also maybe a little bit surprised to see some of the messages we thought are generally helpful were less helpful than we expected. Building affordable housing in my neighborhood will ensure my children and parents are able to live here in the future. That generated 51% support. Not bad, but not as strong of support as some of the others. And similarly, more affordable housing in my neighborhood would support local businesses, generating 46% agreement. This is a message as a long-time affordable housing industry, someone in the industry for a long time. I was surprised to see the result because we've long been taught that affordable housing is economic development. But right now, in the current climate, this is not a top concern among voters. They're really concerned about safety, livability, and access to housing for all incomes. So not as strong of a message, not a bad message, but just not as strong. We also tested some specific messages to help address some specific issues. This first one about shelter. Affordable housing takes time to plan and build, but it creates permanent housing stability for those in need. I think it's more important to invest in long-term solutions like affordable housing rather than short-term solutions like shelters. Sorry, the number there cut off, but it's 83%. This was a very, very strongly resonating message. Voters agree in long-term permanent solutions. So that is something you can take with you when you're hearing the tension between investing in shelters versus investing in affordable housing. And then secondly, many of you experience questions and pushback about the cost of housing, especially the cost of developing affordable housing. And some of that cost because of it comes from where we intentionally want to build housing in high opportunity neighborhoods to give families with lower incomes the opportunity to live with access to good schools, transit, jobs, etc. So we tested this message. Some neighborhoods offer more services and amenities, such as access to public transportation, libraries, healthcare clinics, and it makes sense to build more housing in these neighborhoods with services, even if the land is more expensive. Again, another message that resonates well with voters. So again, these are meant to be tools to help you have complicated questions in the community as you go out to support these future affordable homes. Meanwhile, there are some questions or concerns that voters continue to have. These measures or these messages did not generate a majority of support, but they're important to be mindful of. Voters are still somewhat concerned that additional affordable housing has an impact on property taxes. There's no demonstration of that correlation, but it's a sentiment that voters carry with them. And similarly, some worry that there's a relationship between safety and affordable housing. So these are not messages to lead with, but these are results to be aware of and mindful of in conversations you're having with the community. Speaking of engaging with the community, we were really surprised and heartened to see that the question, "My neighborhood already has enough affordable housing," really doesn't resonate at all. Only one in four voters thinks that their neighborhood has enough housing, and the cross tabs demonstrate that those are pretty much the same voters who just don't want more affordable housing in their neighborhood. So there's generally widespread agreement that every neighborhood needs more affordable housing. And building more affordable housing should be a neighborhood decision, not something imposed by local governments. We wanted to test voter feelings, and we're not suggesting here that this should be left up to neighborhood decision, but it's an important reminder about involving community in the conversations about future affordable housing projects, which is the work that you're often doing. And so being mindful to affirm that interest in the community members to be involved in these decisions where it's appropriate, not making decisions about design, et cetera, but making decisions about or being in the know about community programming and access and the partners involved in a project. For just a small aside, this was the one question where we noticed the most significant difference between Clackamas and Washington counties and Multnomah County. In fact, in Multnomah County, voters are not interested in being involved in decisions around affordable housing. The understanding is they just want to see action immediately. In Clackamas and Washington counties, there was a higher interest in being involved in the community discussion. So all of that gives us some good reminders about the importance of engagement. Your staff throughout the region who are working with Valeria and I and the team here to implement this housing bond are doing extensive community engagement, utilizing these tactics of engaging neighbors in the project, being clear about the partners in the project. You have a developer, you have an owner and operator, you have service providers, you have the construction crew, and making sure that those roles are clear so that the community understands who it is they can be interacting with and discussing their concerns with, most often the developer slash owner of the project. When you're engaging community in bigger conversations, being mindful not to this is a new community engagement tactic you're probably seeing broadly, not skipping the mic, we say, not leaving the community conversation to the loudest voices in the center of the room, but using breakout groups and post-it notes and other ways for many, many more voices to be heard through community engagement. And then making sure that people have access to contact information so they can be involved and their concerns can be expressed through the process. And then a quick set of reminders for you as elected officials championing and supporting these projects and being sort of in the lead of navigating those challenging community conversations sometimes, making sure that the community is aware of the benefits that come through these new developments, talking about the sidewalk improvements, the activating of the neighborhood that can occur because of these investments, and the housing opportunities that will help reduce homelessness in their community. making sure that neighbors feel valued in their opinions, and they have opportunities to engage in the project. Up the street tomorrow, we're celebrating the grand opening of the Louisa Flowers, a home forward project with 240 new affordable homes for low-income households. And Home Forward made an opportunity for the community to come and bring welcome baskets of houseware items to help welcome the new tenants. So thinking of ways of welcoming our neighbors into our community as opportunities to engage, because the public is very interested and wants to engage in this work of ours. So just as a kind of a recap and a conclusion here, a reminder that a majority, actually two-thirds of voters, are fully in support of affordable housing in their neighborhood, and that support significantly somewhat goes up when you substitute the word neighborhood, which is a little more localized, to community, which can be broader, but sometimes is appropriate in some of the communities that you're working in, where neighbors may think of themselves more in a community orientation than a specific neighborhood orientation. Nonetheless, broad support for affordable housing, specifically in our community and neighborhoods, and so we should feel confident as we bring these projects into our local communities, and we hope that these messages help you in doing so. So any thoughts or questions for Valeria and I for the housing bond implementation or messaging, we're happy to answer.
Yeah, I have a question. In your survey, did you make any allocation in terms of demographics? I'm talking about ages of folks.
You're speaking in the
seniors versus families with young children.
Pardon me. I just want to make sure we understand the question. Is it in pertaining to the messaging survey we asked?
Yeah.
There are cross tabs relating to age, but I don't have any specific data off the top of my mind that it could be helpful.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is my city has a really large senior population, and we've been getting quite a bit of pushback. People fear there'll be crime, there'll be traffic, whatever it is, they're afraid. And I'd be interested if you could provide me any information that might be helpful.
Sure, I'd be happy to dig a little bit deeper into the crosstabs, but also happy to help work on some messages that can be helpful in addressing those concerns.
So you were there a couple days ago to the Build Small, Live Large seminar.
Pardon me.
And there was an intriguing section that I would hope that you could explain a little bit to me, and that was, or to everybody, was where the policymakers, as specifically the one from California, but they were the other from Washington and Oregon seemed to know what she was talking about from California, that where the state had come in a more primary way to mandate certain things, there was going to be then, and that was the trend, but they were going to have a carve-out for geographical areas where the people who had lived there had very little to say about how the planning was going to take place, and they were going to have exceptions built into the state law for helping those particular carve-outs have more autonomy and more input. Do you remember that at all?
Sorry, Councillor Koloff, I don't remember. This is the Build Small, Live Large conference last week.
Which session was it?
It was the policy one.
Okay.
The three policy directors, mm-hmm. which was very interesting, the three policy directors for the three electeds were the ones speaking. But it seemed to hold hope to get at the antagonism that may be there. Perhaps not, who knows, but appears to be at least an issue with House Bill 2001 that, you know, it was all mandated and all taken over and God forbid. But I thought that was a very creative way where appropriate, and I was hoping to hear more about that. If you had heard anything on the state level, it seemed that the state of Oregon was not as far along in developing this, but clearly it was in the California law. Okay.
I'm sorry. I don't think I can have anything I can add.
Well, then what, we know where we're going to get some more research. Put you to work. Yeah. Okay.
So we are going to be talking about House Bill 2001 for next week.
Okay.
So that should help, I think, answer some of the questions that you had with the pushback piece.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that'll be part of it. Thank you. You've been great. All right. We appreciate it. So are there any other questions tonight? I know I've had a long day. I imagine the rest of you have, too. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. We'll see you closer to Christmas.